with office buildings, it's getting now easier to be able to persuade a client that there is a cost benefit to building in timber, that you can rent timber buildings or sell timber buildings for more money. Because exactly as you say, Bethan, people really enjoy being around timber. It reduces your blood pressure. It makes you feel happier, reduces your stress levels. You sleep better at night in a timber building. So people stay longer at work. They're more productive. And then these buildings, because they're visibly sustainable, they demonstrate a kind of clear commitment of those businesses towards sustainability and to health and to well-being. So that kind of projects a really positive image of that company.
Welcome to the WGSN Create Tomorrow podcast. In today's episode, we have with us Andrew Waugh, co-founder of British architecture practice Waugh Thistleton, which is just 1 year older than WGSN, I believe, at 26 years old. Waugh Thistleton has created numerous projects from restaurants to residential and mixed-use developments, but the practice is known best for championing wood as the best building material for the future. We've invited Andrew onto the podcast to discuss the potent power of engineered timber and how it might help us to create a better future for people and planet. So Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
In your cupboard?
In my cupboard, in my Zoom cupboard.
Right, so you have been, not to age you, but you've been an architect for some time now. And I wanted to ask, when you started to recognise that we had to change the way we build, and was it from the kind of the late 90s when you set up the practice, or did it kind of come to you gradually over time?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't to begin with. And it did come, you're absolutely right, Beth, and it came over time. And it came, I guess, as we began to, you know, as conversation around sustainability has grown and we've engaged with it. And so over the years, we've begun to understand more about the implications of what it is that we do in construction, in architecture, and the impact that that has on the environment, has on kind of carbon emissions. So it's become increasingly important to us. And certainly when I was at college, it wasn't really on my radar.
I mean, I guess you're quite a fan of modernism, right? And modernism in itself is concrete, steel and glass. So do you think that's one of the reasons why it's taken a little bit of while for it to percolate?
Yeah, I think there's that. I think there's definitely that. I mean, I am a modernism. I'm a modernist, definitely. But for me, modernism is more about a way of thinking than specifically an aesthetic response. So it's about democracy, it's about people, it's about technology, it's about an optimism for the future. It's about those sorts of things. So I think that the way I see the opportunity for making things better, for building better buildings, is through the kind of articulation of modernism to make a sustainable architecture. I guess that, you know, when I was at college, when I first started in practice, the kind of whole kind of straw bales and mushrooms and kind of all of that stuff, just, it didn't gel with me. It didn't excite me. I didn't see that as a future that I could celebrate.
That's really interesting, because it's something we're coming back to. I mean, obviously concrete is getting a lot of, but it's deeply harmful to the environment in terms of carbon release and things. Is that something, do you believe in the possibility of a kind of green concrete?
I think that green concrete is greenwash. I think that it's not just about the cement. It's also about the sand. It's about the amount of water. It's about the aggregates. It's about the transportation. It's about the fact that those buildings aren't adaptable after they're made because it's such a solid material. And it's also about the kind of health and well-being of those buildings as well. You know, I think that the idea that we live in these kind of, you know, these karst caves, it's not healthy.
Mm. I mean, when did you discover yourself that you could kind of build an entire building in solid timber?
Well, we built our first cross-laminated timber, so what we call mass timber building, in 2003.
Really?
So long ago. And it was a nightclub. It was.
Oh, wow. Brilliant.
Right?
Nightclubs are always at the forefront
exactly,
of innovation.
Exactly. It was a private members club for classical musicians. And it was a little three-story extension in South London. And it was just about 300 or 400 square feet. And it was a really beautiful process. We designed this kind of little jewelry box that sat inside this landlocked yard. And we lifted it in with a crane on a Saturday afternoon, put it into place. A couple of people put it together with cordless screwdrivers. It was absolutely pristine and perfect and millimeter perfect. And I was sold. I thought, this is a great way to build.
And that was like on a very small scale, right? Yeah. So at what point did you start to realize it could be scaled up? Were you looking, I mean, interesting what's going on around the rest of the world. I get the impression we are behind other parts of the world in this. Were there other places that you visited or that you saw that you got influenced on doing this, that you were like, well, they're doing it really well there, why can't we do that here?
A little bit. So, you know, we built, after that little house extension, that little building extension in 2003, we built another couple of small projects in CLT, but it had begun to kind of dawn on me that this material could be, you know, a different way of building. It could be, at the time, I'll be honest, it was more about prefabrication. It was more about the idea that you could prefabricate a kind of kit of parts for a building that you could then build on site. I was aware that this was a way of building which didn't produce any waste or didn't produce any excess and could be delivered and very neatly put together on site. The carbon angle for us really came at the same sort of time as we were building the building, at the same sort of time as understanding about embodied carbon, so upfront carbon, you know, the carbon of construction, of building materials, or that kind of thing. And that it really, so in 2008, when we built Murray Grove, there weren't any other buildings made of mass timber in the world that were of that scale. So it was the first one. In fact, so much so that the inventor of CLT contacted me, invited me over to Italy to meet him. And we kind of sat in this cafe where he kind of grilled me about he wasn't sure it was a good idea and stuff.
It might fall down.
Still there, 15 years later.
What were his fears? What was he quizzing? Was he just sort of worried about the scale?
Well, they invented cross-laminated timber in Austria in the 90s because the demand for paper was going down and they needed to use some of their trees because they have these massive sustainably managed forests across Austria, about 70% of Austria. And so they were looking for a way to use more timber and to make it kind of more, you know, structurally acceptable, so it's structurally kind of capable in larger projects. But they hadn't really thought of that in terms of height. So Murray Grove is 9 stories, and they hadn't really built anything more than 2 or 3 stories by then. So it was quite a shift. But what we were able to demonstrate by doing that, saying, well, actually, this material, this natural, replenishable material that's made of carbon, is low carbon to produce and stores carbon, like a tree stores carbon. And this is a viable alternative to concrete and steel. This is something where what we think of in the practice is like a policy car crash. You know, you've got housing need and the climate crisis. Both of them are kind of exacerbating each other. You know, as people move from the countryside to the city because of climate crisis, the city needs to go larger, but actually that produces more carbon. So how can you build our cities? How can we densify our cities in a low carbon way? And this material seemed to us to be a viable way of doing that. For the first time, a material that was low carbon, but we could build at scale.
Absolutely, because I think the figures are something like, I don't know about most recent figures, but in terms of embodied carbon, which is obviously from building and everything that happens around the manufacturing and construction industry, is something like 40% of global carbon emissions, right? So if you can get rid of that, you're doing something pretty major for the planet.
It's massive. It really is a big impact. And currently in the UK and, you know, much of Europe and the US, we have no laws. We have no legislation which advocates for reducing that carbon.
I mean, for the layperson, can you just explain CLT in a very simple way? It's obviously incredibly strong, right? Which is what makes it usable.
Absolutely. So what we're talking about is big slabs of timber. And those slabs are made up of planks, generally made of a pine tree or a spruce tree. And they're planks which are about 18 millimeters by about, say, 75 millimeters. And those planks are laid out and then they're sprayed with a PU adhesive. So that's like a kind of copied X like you get at school between your hands. They're sprayed with a PU adhesive, and then another layer of planks are put down on top of them, perpendicular to the layer below. So 90 degrees to the layer below. And then you build those up in odd numbers. So the bottom layer and the top layer are running parallel. And then in between them, you have sandwiches of layers running alternate ways. And then that slab is put through a big machine, a press, comes out of the factory about 20 meters long by about 3 meters wide. And then you cut out, and then you put it into a CNC machine, and you cut out the doors or you cut out the windows. So what arrives on site is this large, generally large piece of timber with all the right pieces cut out of it. And that can be for, you know, rainwater pipes or windows or the edge of a roof or something like that. They're piled on top of this truck. They're brought to site and they're craned up and put into position and then screwed down with cordless screwdrivers.
I'm interested about what sort of what the challenges are to kind of moving this forward and us ending up with cities of timber in the future. I mean, what have been the challenges along the way for you? Has it been hard to convince clients?
Yes, it is changing, finally. You know, the frustrating thing, especially in the UK, is that we have very little policy or legislation around low carbon construction in the UK, certainly compared to other places. So where we actually, in the UK, we really started this. This was a UK innovation. Murray Grove was closely followed by other real groundbreaking projects by other practices, by other engineers at the time. And, you know, we were building a real, really exciting body of knowledge in the 2010s. And following Grenfell, the perception around timber really changed. There was a kind of knee-jerk reaction from legislators and around policy. And so 2017, we were 15% of the global CLT market. And last year, we were less than 1%.
Right. So we have quite a global audience. So for those unfamiliar, the Grenfell fire tragedy in 2017 was when a residential London high-rise with combustible cladding caught fire and killed 72 people. So with that in mind, Andrew, some might argue that timber would be an increased fire risk. So could you talk to this claim?
It does burn. It is combustible. You're absolutely right. And we're very careful about that. And we work with the world's best fire engineers to make sure the way in which we design and detail and build the buildings is to the greatest fire safety that we can possibly get to. And we do that with a number of different ways. Primarily, we put plasterboard over the majority of the structure in order to protect it, just like you would with steel. And timber is generally quite predictable in fire, so you know what it's going to do. With concrete, you know the moisture that gets trapped within concrete. When it's under fire, that moisture expands and then the concrete explodes. And then the reinforcement bar within the concrete, that melts and the concrete loses its strength and buckles. But you never know exactly where that's happened or how it's happened. So they're very dangerous buildings. With timber, we have a much more predictable process, but primarily it's about protecting the timber. And then we also understand that timber, as it burns, chars. So it doesn't just, you know, immediately ignite. And certainly when you see, at first at least, certainly when you see forest fires, when you see the aftermath of a forest fire, you quite often see the kind of the blackened trunks of those trees remaining. And that's because a tree self-protects itself by charring. So, you know, if you have a fire at home and you've got matchsticks, they burn up very quickly. But if you have a big lump of timber and you put that on the fire, when you wake up in the morning, that's generally there.
You're listening to Create Tomorrow, the WGSN podcast. And in this episode, we're talking about the power of engineered timber and how it might help us to create a better future for people and planet. I'm Bethan Ryder, Director of Editorial at WGSN, and my guest today is Andrew Waugh, co-founder with Anthony Thistleton of British architecture practice Waugh Thistleton. It seems to be increasingly people want wood around them. So I think other than the sustainability angle, clearly it's good for wellness, it's good for reducing stress. Are there things there that clients are starting to come to understand that they do want to surround people with timber for these reasons? Or does it always just come down to cost when you're working for a client?
Generally, yeah. And you know, with office buildings, it's getting now kind of easier to be able to persuade a client that there is a cost benefit to building in timber, that you can rent timber buildings or sell timber buildings for more money. Because exactly as you say, Bethan, people really enjoy being around timber. It reduces your blood pressure. It makes you feel happier, reduces your stress levels. You sleep better at night in a timber building. You know, so people stay longer at work. They're more productive. And then these buildings, because they're visibly sustainable, they demonstrate a kind of clear commitment of those businesses toward sustainability and to health and to well-being. So that kind of projects a really positive image of that company.
Presumably, the reason why people want to be feeling better around timber, I mean, what do you think? Is it because essentially we're meant to be in nature and we're kind of part of nature?
Yeah, we're animals. Yeah.
That's simple.
I think it's that simple. I think, you know, you're talking about a material. I think it's actually really intriguing. It's simple, but really intriguing. So I think it's about the moisture that the timber accepts and releases. You know, that it helps to kind of like mitigate humidity in the atmosphere. I think it's about the pattern of the timber. You know, I think it's about where the eye wanders across the grain and seeing the knots. I think there's a joy. I think there's a memory of kind of being in nature as well. I think there's so many different aspects of this which are pleasing.
I mean, I love the black and white building for TOG, the office group in Shoreditch, was sort of, I suppose, your last big success in this realm, really, or your most recent, not last, your most recent. And I love that Ollie Wainwright in The Guardian kind of called it an eco office block miracle and said that he wanted to caress the lift. What did you break grounds? Were there new things that you did with that building that you had not done in previous buildings? What was new in terms of taking it a step further with sustainability?
I think a few things. I think working with TOG, working with Daytrip, we really celebrated the biophilic and the well-being kind of nature of the material. It was, you know, it's lots of timber furniture inside, lots of timber finishes, express timber desks and tables, and coffee tables, etc. So that was really, I think, an important part of what's different, what's new, what's innovative about this building for us. Also, we use a lot less timber on this building per square meter than we've used on buildings before. So we're getting better and better, reducing the amount of timber that we use. So we're understanding the engineering capacity of the timber much better, understanding how we can therefore reduce the amount of timber that we use. So that excites me a lot because, you know, we talk a lot in the practice about this architecture of sufficiency, you know, that you do just enough to be sufficient. You know, you pare it right down and it's not minimalism. You know, it's not kind of like, it's not an artificial notion of paring down, but it's actually just using what you need to be, what it needs to be sufficient, and celebrating that kind of beauty of sufficiency, you know, in a kind of Shaker-esque type sort of way. And so I'm very excited about that. We had a client who was really engaged and really positive about what we were doing and the innovation that we were excited about. And so this is our 30th completed CLT building in the UK and France. And every project, we learn from the last project. Every project that's built includes ideas from several that weren't built. You know, so it's a constant concurrent learning of how to do this. And we have buildings, the next one that we have on site will be in Milan. The next one after that, probably on the West Coast in Seattle. So yeah, all over the place.
It's spreading.
Yeah.
I have to throw an AI question in since it's just all around us at the moment. What's interesting is you've worked to this point where you've got down to the very sparest way to build, say, the TOG building, and maybe there'll be another building coming up where you kind of perfect that even more. That could clearly be fed into an AI generative tool. It could be like open source. Other people could use it around the world. I mean, what's your feeling about how this might change how you work in the future?
Yeah, fascinating. I don't know. But you're right. You know, we work in systems and components. We have somebody in the office. We're not a big office by any means, not a big practice, but we do have somebody in the practice who is a coder. And that's what they do. And they build parametric studies for us. We do a lot of systems buildings. So we're doing lots of logistics centers, for instance. We're doing schools. We're doing other buildings which are about system design, residential buildings in the US, which are about system design, which are about repeatable design or repeatable process of design that will, and that process will throw up a different type of building each time, given the context and the climate and the brief, but the process is similar. So we're building up a kind of a parametric understanding. So by parametric, what you really mean is that you describe the parameters of a problem. Right. So you describe the parameters of a problem and then you look for machine learning to begin to kind of solve that problem within the parameters that you create. So there's still input from us to create those parameters. But one of the things I love about the way in which we're learning to design and learning to build with this material is that you have this super natural material from the forest, you know, and as a studio, we've been up into the Alps, we've been up into Scotland, we've met lumberjacks and foresters and sawmills. I mean, it's really, really exciting. It's lovely to be that close to the source of your material and to talk to those people about how they're grown, how they're regrown. You know, it's really fascinating. But twinned with that is the sophistication of the process that goes into drawing, designing, and engineering and the manufacturing of this timber. So you have this supernatural material that responds so well to humankind that it's replenishable, but the way in which we put it together is incredibly sophisticated.
It sounds like you kind of are not scared by AI. You actually can see the merging of using it as a tool for creativity, and you're not particularly scared. Like, you don't see in 10 years, oh my goodness, there might just be me and my co-founder of the practice and we won't need anyone else. Well, I mean, you're not daunted by the capabilities of it.
No. I'm a modernist. Bring it on. It's great. I'm really excited. I want to see what happens. I guess my only worry is that any AI system kind of worth its salt is very quickly going to see that humans are the problem. That's the only issue I can foresee. But I'm an Asimov fan as well. I read loads of science fiction. So yeah, bring it on. Bring on the future. I love it.
Have you seen that there is this Stockholm set to have the largest wooden city? I don't know if you've read anything about that.
I have, about Henning Larsson. Yeah, it's fantastic. I went to see them recently. And yeah, it's really interesting. It's really exciting. And those are the cities of the future. I just hope they don't get too tall.
Keep it low rise.
I think one of the problems in architecture we've had for a long time now is how we see success in architecture. You know, how we define success in architecture. And for too long, it's been the kind of the weirdest or most idiosyncratic form of building, or the tallest building. And surely we should be building the happiest buildings, or the nicest buildings to be in, or the best looking building in that row of kind of like, you know, row of other buildings, not the one that stands out. You know, I just think that kind of like that notion of sort of pop culture, of individual stardom, that's something that we need to lose. That's something that we need to kind of walk away from.
Which I have to say, you might tell me off for this, but I feel is a product of the fact that it's a very male-dominated industry.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's just been, as you say, like literally the tallest building. I mean, I could make all sorts of analogies to that. But do you see it changing? Are more women coming in? Is this going to be, obviously, you're very different from this way of doing things, but do you see that being part of the positive change?
I wish it was. I don't think it's changed enough. I don't think the change is fast enough. When I was in architecture school, it was about 50-50. I think it's probably even more than 50-50 now at architecture school. I think there are more women than men in architecture school generally. You don't see it in the profession yet, and certainly not when you get into your 50s. You still don't see it, and it's something that as a practice we talk about a lot and we think about a lot. So it's by no means perfect, and it needs lots more work and lots more kind of positive action taken about it. I mean, one of the really problematic things is that architecture fees are low and architectural education is expensive. So you study for 5 years, and even if they do reduce it to 4 years, you're still studying for 4 years with a massive amount of debt, and then coming out of that with not an easy way to pay it back. So that's difficult for men and for women, right?
What's the one thing you'd like to see happen? And if you could make it global, not just for the UK, but what's the one thing that you think needs to happen to make these timber cities a reality and more widespread? What do you think are the biggest challenges?
We need carbon taxes. We need carbon taxes. In Europe, we burn more trees than we build with. We need to get a mature understanding of how we treat our forests, to protect old growth forests, to harvest managed forests, to understand, have, you know, a mature understanding about how we work with forests to engender biodiversity within those forests, et cetera. So I think we really need to get better at that. I think we need carbon taxes. So we need to start not subsidizing oil and gas in the way in which we do. We need to make brave decisions as a society. I want to see PVs. I want to see photovoltaics, solar panels across the Houses of Parliament. You know, let's put those on the Houses of Parliament. Let's start really just saying, we're in a freaking emergency. Let's start making some solutions. Let's start pulling together as a society and trying to get some solutions.
That's a brilliant way to end it. I love it. I can picture it. Instead of projecting, what was that naked girl that got projected on the House of Parliament in the 90s? Instead of projecting, we should have solar panelling on it. Much better, much better. Thank you so much for your time, Andrew. It's really interesting and important work that you're doing.
No, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to Andrew Waugh, co-founder of British architecture practice Waugh Thistleton, for taking the time to speak to me today. If you're a WGSN subscriber, you'll find reports covering future cities on Insight and trends around timber on our interiors platform, and that includes a trend curve all about wood. And if you want to find out how to subscribe, head over to WGSN.com to discover how you can get access to our service. We're constantly publishing new content focusing on how we can design a brighter, better future for our industries, including food and drink, interiors, beauty, fashion, and consumer tech. You can subscribe on all major podcast platforms. And if you like what you've heard, why not leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts? We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode, and you can catch the CEO of WGSN, Carla Buzashi, next week on our other podcast, Lives of Tomorrow, where we'll be looking at the fascinating topic of the future of Gen Z.